What? His voice rose an octave. Yo, Shug, he married to a black chick. He likes a little color, Mo. We spoke in broad terms about the organization, and Shug and Pipe sketched it out on the back of a napkin. They argued about who was a founding member and who wasn't. I asked where everyone was now. Pipe filled me in on a few gang members and said matter-of-factly, Twin, he's dead. He killed him. I didn't understand. He killed him, Pipe repeated, nodding at Shug. Shug smiled, mock sheepish. Pipe drew a small diagram with unfamiliar names. Me and Pipe, we here, he said, indicating where they were on the list of sex money murder leaders. Shug pointed to Pipe. He's a rat bastard. And the infamous Peter Rolock? Life plus 125 years. Shug continued with a soliloquy on how Pete hated bullies and always stood against them. He looked at me. And his composure is even 10 times smoother than yours. Shug was paying me an offhand compliment, at the same time indicating how silent and deadly Pete could be. He told the story of hunting for Twin in a gold Cadillac, claiming 50 Cent had immortalized the scene in his song, I'll Whip Your Head, Boy. Shug, grinning, went to his phone and showed me a YouTube video, nodding his head in time with the plangent chords. Two niggas in the front, two niggas in the back. That's four niggas riding strapped in Grandpa's Cadillac. Both detailed their shootings, Shug laughing when someone got rocked before telling the story of the murder Twin committed in Sweetwaters. It's faking left, going right, 'cause we gonna kill you regardless, said Shug. When we rock you to sleep, it's like we trying to put you to sleep. Make you feel comfortable, added Pipe. Later in the conversation, though, I could see that Pipe wasn't as enamored of gangster life as Shug. When I asked why he wanted to tell his story, he replied flatly, People need to understand that we're not animals. Yes, we sold crack and we killed people. But I only played the hand I was dealt. I had moms, sisters who I loved. I want people to know that anyone caught up in gang life is a human being. A silence followed. Shug followed Pipe's lead. We want people to know that the streets don't love you. They never did. If people get that message from telling our story, then that's what we want. We agreed that it was preferable to meet on neutral ground away from where they lived. A white man visiting Shug in the projects on a regular basis would bring suspicion. And John O'Malley had one rule of his own for me. You're never to have them in your house. O'Malley didn't fully trust either of them and told me several times to be careful. The next meeting, a month later, we learned more about each other. Shug had nicknamed me J.G., but this time he was agitated as we stood in a restaurant parking lot while he and Pipe smoked. He and his girlfriend, Pipe's sister, were fighting. She'd called him a rat. Our women are representations of who we are and our lives, said Shug. Inside the restaurant, Shug pulled up Twin's picture from a Facebook page on my iPhone. That look he has in the picture is the same look he gave me when I killed him, he said. A few weeks earlier, Twin's brother had written to Shug on Facebook asking for a meeting. Shug was thinking about consenting. Pipe talked him out of it. You crazy, man, he said. He's setting you up. We talked for 7 hours. You sure you can handle the story of sex money murder, J.G.? Said Pipe. It ain't no joke. I pulled out a New York Times piece about the Thanksgiving Day shooting. Shug read it while I talked with Pipe. Yo, look at Yolanda Tellin, blurted Shug, pointing to one of the sources in the piece. Shug expected no one to talk in Soundview. We ended the meeting, and Pipe and Shug asked to be dropped at the bodega on the corner to get some Lucy's. As I parked, I saw two Bloods coming our way. Pipe had seen them before I had. He didn't miss a beat as they marched up and threw down the Blood handshake, pulling their hands back to form the B. Pipe threw his forefingers in the air, the sign of the sex money murder set. They spoke a while before Shug and Pipe got back in the car, laughing. Homeboys say they busting their joints over here at night in little beefs, Pipe said. Niggas will never learn. They were food for the Bloods, and yet here they were, greeted warmly and unharmed. Shug and Pipe didn't explain why. The code was baroque and inconsistent. We dropped Shug off at the Metro North train station. From a thronging commuter train, Shug leaned out of the closing doors, his jeans drooping below his buttocks and his baseball cap with its oversized brim at a rakish angle. "I love you, J.G.," he yelled at me. The few commuters pretended not to notice. As I started my research, word leaked out that Shug and Pipe were working with a journalist on a book. I got a threatening email from Cod in March 2013. "All I ask you to do is be 2 + 2 = 4 before you go any further with this," he wrote. But in the ensuing months I came to respect both Shug and Pipe for their willingness to tell this story publicly, beyond most concerns for their own safety, so that the truth could be told. Pistol Pete had in some way devastated both their lives. Shug wanted it known that Pete had betrayed him. He felt no compunction about selling him out in return for his own benefit. And Pipe wanted people to know that he had never turned on Pete despite everything that had happened. Both men say they still love him. To tell the full story, I needed O'Malley and Forselli as well. Forselli agreed and offered support. O'Malley at first demurred. He hated the limelight and went out of his way to avoid it. When a documentary was made about Pistol Pete, producers approached O'Malley, and he declined to cooperate. "I don't like kicking a man when he is down," he said. "Look, I just wanted to help Shug and Pipe by connecting them with you. They wanted to tell their story. This isn't about John O'Malley." I told him that I needed to explore the complexities of a serious racketeering case and the process of flipping cooperators. He knew that there was value in revealing the benefits of the federal system in terms of both reducing crime and offering those who cooperate a fresh start. The revolving door of the state system increases gang membership because inmates are compelled to join gangs to survive in prison. But those who cooperate federally are alienated from their neighborhoods and have to start anew once they're released. O'Malley wanted the same system they'd used at the Southern District. Federal intervention and the flipping of cooperators by former detectives from the neighborhoods to be implemented in Chicago, Baltimore, and other cities where the murders of young black men had skyrocketed. He agreed to be interviewed. All New Yorkers know the small, one-paragraph mentions of murders that are our regular diet of the daily newspapers. The latest violent death of a young black kid, sometimes an abstraction to readers in Manhattan and elsewhere, may as well be happening in another country. But just north of my Manhattan apartment was a world as dangerous and ruthless as any I had experienced as a journalist reporting in the favelas of Brazil, the garrisons of Kingston, Jamaica, or the killing fields of Colombia. In working on this book, I was surprised to find out how many of those daily murders in the newspapers were connected. I sat for hours in the Bronx DA's office and watched murder scene footage and recognized the same names over and over, sex money murder members or associates. I was shocked, too, to realize that my own life had brushed up against so much of the territory of this story. A family friend, a federal agent, had, it turned out, arrested Shug. In the beginning, I had a sense that Shug and Pipe had been molded by their environment. But after the first two meetings and then scores of phone calls late into the night, it became obvious that the two were markedly different, and in many ways unrepresentative of Soundview. In the summer of 2013, Shug and I began a voyage into his past, starting in Springfield. In a restaurant, we ran into one of his old friends, recently out of the federal penitentiary. With expensive gold fronts and his arms etched in ink, he took one look at me at the bar and pulled back, asking to speak to Shug privately. When, after a long, playful exchange on their own, they came back to join me, the other man asked, "You sure you're not a cop?" He looked into my face as if peering through a dusty window. I shook my head. "Man, you need to get at least a tattoo or something. You're way too clean-cut. How you going to roll with my boy Sugar if you look like the 5-0? When I said I hadn't found anything I liked enough to mark my body with permanently, he screwed up his face in surprise at my English accent. "Shit, nigga sounds like Hugh Grant. What the fuck?" A few days later, my wife dropped into the cafe where Sugar and I were talking. She brought along our newborn son. Shug blushed deeply. Why didn't you tell me your wife was coming, J.G.? He picked at his black hoodie and jeans. I'm dressed like a street thug, like I'm about to do something. If I'd have known, I would have dressed nice. Shug fussed over our son. When my wife started to put the car seat on the ground temporarily to remove her coat, he jumped out of his seat. You can't put little J.G. on the floor. He picked up the baby, clearing a space at the table. I began to see a radical disconnect between how he viewed people and how they viewed him. When we went to a bodega in the north end of Springfield, he wanted the owner to tell me stories about his old exploits on the block. A small man with a mustache stood behind the counter, chatting pleasantly to one of his customers. When he caught sight of Shug standing in the doorway, a look of pure terror crossed his face. He ducked behind the counter and seemed to be reaching for a weapon. Shug had expected a warm reception. He couldn't understand the man's fear. After we interviewed Gina, his former girlfriend, who told me about buying several of each outfit in case Shug tore one up in jealousy, we took a break in Robinson State Park. I never knew she did that, J.G., he said sorrowfully in a moment of introspection. I feel bad. We sat looking out at the river, and Shug seemed disappointed with himself. Within minutes he was on his cell phone, shouting at his son, who was caught up in gang life. Regret was fleeting. As I got to know Shug, I experienced the darker and more unpredictable side of his personality. Even after our second meeting, his temper rose. He pulled out of the project before agreeing to it again, a situation that recurred often over the 5 years it took to report this book. Sometimes he threatened me on the phone. O'Malley told me that he suspected Shug suffered from a bipolar disorder. I called Pipe to see what was up. Listen, J.G., he said, Shug's out of line. We never carried ourselves like that in the street, and we don't carry ourselves like that now. Shug needs to fall back into line, or I'll have to straighten him out. Pipe reminded me of an old mafia godfather, the old-fashioned outliers who held out against narcotics trafficking. When Shug stepped off a bus in November 2013, after shouting at me on the phone from New York, he gave me a firm hug, joking and slapping me on the back. Reluctantly, I smiled. "Yo, you and Pipe is close," he said somewhat suspiciously. "Thank you for letting me express myself." That was Shug. His mood could turn on a dime from deadly rage to sappy warmth. Meanwhile, Pipe mentored me in the code of the street. He taught me how to spot liars, to read when someone was faking moves, and, crucially, how to move in the neighborhoods. Pipe and I slipped into Soundview several times from late 2013 onward, driving through Cozy Corner to see how the neighborhood had changed. It became second nature for me to roll the seat back so that my head was protected by the doorpost and to drive hunched over the wheel, a baseball cap tipped low. Pipe told me not to pull directly alongside a car with tinted windows and flashy rims, to hang back a few feet so our heads were not level with its doors. When he caught me reading Machiavelli once, he said, "That shit'll help you understand Shug." I asked Pipe if he felt he might get Shug a job at the hospital. I knew how hard it was to land work as a felon. "Are you joking, J.G.?" he said. "Boy would lose his temper within the first 2 days, or smoke himself stupid with the first paycheck and not go back. I ain't putting my job on the line." We spoke about their relationship. "One thing about Shug," said Pipe, "is that he would ride it out with you no matter what. He is loyal to the end. If I ever have a problem, I'm not going to call J.O., I'm going to call Shug, and I'm going to call Roe." But as Pipe drifted further from his old life, he realized that Shug would only do so with an incentive, that his allegiance was fierce but strictly conditional on how it would benefit himself. I realized at some point that Pipe had never told Shug where he lived. After a year or so, Pipe trusted me enough to introduce me to Roe and his ailing father. In an apartment jammed with pit bulls and a blasting television, Roe, his body sculpted by the weight bench, broke down the tragedy of Twin's murder. Suspicious of me at first, he eventually told me that he had cried after they killed him. Pipe's father spoke about his own years as a gangster and a loan shark, his struggle with heroin addiction, and his time in prison. As Shug's and Pipe's narratives diverged, I wondered what it was about Shug, who had it easier than Pipe by some stretch, that prevented him from settling into a straight civilian life. "As long as I don't kill no one, I'm good," he always answered me. "No one's perfect. My life ain't no fairy tale." Shug led a progressively itinerant and rootless life, surviving on craftiness and animal instinct. He made friends quickly and burned them just as fast. Every few weeks he would change cell numbers and I'd get calls from different area codes, Vermont, Florida, various parts of New York, and other places. He might find a job but last no more than 8 weeks before drifting away, drawn back to the dissolute life of the street. He lived a life on the run, a man on self-destruct who obscured his past and yet reveled in it, existing on charity and some he knew in the gang life who put him up before he moved on after a falling out or a fresh arrest. In the early summer of 2014, Pipe called to say that Shug had gotten caught up with a crew and was hustling in Harlem, and that it wasn't safe for me to meet with him anymore. "I just don't want Shug to get hurt in the streets," Pipe says. "He plays too close to the edge." I pulled back for a few months, and Pipe did, too. It was a familiar pattern by now. When I started this book, I hoped to interview members of the Soundview community, but most attempts to reach ordinary residents met with defeat. I called those who had been at the weed and seed ceremony. No one returned my calls. I emailed. No one answered. I called the Catholic Church. No one called back. I met with prominent local activists who derided my attempts to write about the neighborhood as poverty porn. Promises of help never materialized. The silence was broken by Mike Dunkley, who met me in a Brooklyn Starbucks, and later Mrs. Hines, who welcomed me into her home in the Melrose Projects and relived the murder of her son. Her eldest son had just died of leukemia, having spent his last months in her apartment. She kept a big box of Carlton's letters from the Maine Institute, and letters from colleges that had invited him to come play basketball, Syracuse among them. There was a scrapbook of local newspaper clippings about his basketball games. She pulled out a picture of him in a long fur coat, standing with Carlos Mestre, also murdered by Rolock. "That's the hustler's fur," she said, "when you're making money." By the time we met, she had come to terms with Carlton's passing and even offered forgiveness to Rolock. "I pray for him," she said, "but he still has to do the time." As I got to know Pipe and he began to turn his life around, he had been coming to a different realization. "I don't know about Pete sometimes," he said, half-joking as we sat in a fast-food restaurant in October 2014. "Maybe he would have killed me, too." Pipe and I continued our meetings into 2015 and beyond as he drifted further from the life. We drove to the Bronx and met with Chantal and one of Pipe's sons. As we sat in the car, a couple of gangbangers walked past with their pants drooping down, exposing their boxer shorts. "Look at those little motherfuckers with their pants on the ground," said Pipe derisively, implying, as he always did, that nothing matched sex money murder's professionalism in violence. "We ain't rockin' that pants-on-the-ground shit back in the day. I wore my burner in my belt, yo. How the fuck you wear a gun when you can't even tuck it into your pants? Shit!" O'Malley emailed me every few weeks to stay in touch. He had revised his assessment of Pipe. He felt his rehabilitation was genuine. Pipe explained the appeal of his old life. "You become addicted. You become addicted to the money. You become addicted to the celebrity status. You become addicted to all the fame and attention you get from these bitches, know what I'm saying? So the power you get, even the love that you get from your dudes, know what I mean?" In the summer of 2015, I returned to Soundview Park, which had been made over. The view from the roof where Shug had planned the Thanksgiving murder was now obscured by a waterfront condominium complex. The Friends of Soundview Park, who had cleaned up the park and the Bronx River, had turned a place once choked with weeds and garbage into a lawn where local cricket teams in brightly colored uniforms hit sixes with a soft thwack over the emerald green. The Army Corps of Engineers was reclaiming the salt marshes with clumps of cordgrass. Children played around coolers while parents lounged in beach chairs, the grass glistening from a recent microburst of rain. O'Malley and I took a final drive around the Bronx. We drove to Soundview, where $400,000 condos dotted his old neighborhood. And in the 40th Precinct, a war zone where the C&C crew and the hitman Justice had once roamed the streets, we saw millennials in skinny jeans and oversized Ray-Ban aviators heading into loft apartments. Developers called it the Piano District. "No one invests in an area where bullets are flying," said O'Malley, thrilled to see the progress. But the Soundview houses were impervious to change. A man was shot and killed outside 1725 Randall Avenue, Shug's old building, a few days after we drove through. Over the course of writing Sex, Money, Murder, I did several tours with the police in the area. A couple of cops took me on a vertical patrol in the houses. The stairwells still smelled of urine. There was a broken toilet seat in one and some syringes in another. Blood graffiti marked the walls. On Cozy Corner, knots of youths looked at me venomously, eyeing my camera. "It's Fed TV," they said, sidling off into the night. I did a 4-to-midnight tour with a patrol car in the 43rd. On the walls of the muster room were the faces of the new gangs controlling the area. A new Crips set, the Stratford Avenue crew, rubbed up against territory dominated by the Morrison Avenue boys, a blood set. The angry faces reminded me of Shug and Pipe, and of the constant churning of young lives lost to gang culture. A young homicide detective from the 43rd told me, "We arrest gang bangers and they talk about Pistol Pete like he's some fucking Robin Hood. I'm like, he didn't give anything to you or your family. Why is he Robin Hood to you? Then they look at me like I'm the one who's nuts. All it would take is another drug like crack, and all this will go up again." O'Malley retired in 2015. With the feds, he'd solved well over 400 homicides and put away some of New York's most dangerous men. Sex, Money, Murder was one of the last big crews that had a long run, almost 10 years from inception. When O'Malley left the Southern District, street crews like Sex, Money, Murder were generally in handcuffs within a year or two, certainly after the first couple of homicides. Crime dropped in New York City from 1990 to 2000 twice as much as in any other major American city. It became known as the New York Miracle. The biggest decrease in homicides in all boroughs was in the Bronx, partially attributed by some to the work of O'Malley and Glazer. O'Malley declined a big farewell function, but Liz Glazer held a private party to celebrate his career. They presented him with an inscribed mug. It read, "John O'Malley, Slayer of Kings, Master of Preachers, Bleeder of Bloods, and Our Guiding Light, for 20 years and forever, USAO, SDNY, 1994 to 2015. The head of the FBI, James Comey, had gotten to know O'Malley while working as a Southern District prosecutor, and they had both been involved in BMO's conviction. He called to offer his regards. Earlier that year, O'Malley had watched his son receive the Gold Shield as a newly minted detective for his service on the police force and a SWAT team. He'd be the third-generation O'Malley family detective. O'Malley's house buzzed with excitement. The family would drive in a small procession to the town hall. John thought back to Danny in his detective suit at church when he was 8 years old, and all those times the phone would ring with Justice on the other end. He regretted that Annie's father, a legendary Bronx detective, wasn't around to see his grandson receive the Gold Shield. As the family got ready to climb into their cars, the TV blared in the corner of the house. Fox News was broadcasting a wave of protests aimed at police treatment of African Americans. In some ways, O'Malley felt relief that his father-in-law wasn't around to witness the backlash and eventual murders of policemen after the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. In the course of his career, O'Malley had seen 800 to 1,000 dead bodies, all beyond the glare of TV cameras or social activists who had never been inside a New York City housing project controlled by a gang. He wished that people could walk in his shoes for one day, make an arrest of a violent felon like Justice, explain to the grieving mothers in the projects about their slaughtered loved ones, all the while being treated with scorn as they attempted to find the killer. O'Malley switched off the news. Just before they left, his cell phone rang. It was Shug, calling about his own son. He had been arrested with a loaded .380 handgun while out on bail on another gun charge. "Can I get your advice?" Shug asked O'Malley. Shug, 40 and a grandfather, was still the indestructible gunslinger, the wily criminal who could read the streets. He was still sex, money, murder royalty. But he didn't want his son to go to jail, didn't want to lose his boy to the same cycle of violence. O'Malley and Shug were dealing with sons who had chosen the same paths as their fathers, but on opposite ends of the law. It seemed the cycle would never end. And then came the call from O'Malley that I knew some day would come. Shug himself had been arrested in Florida on multiple charges, including possession of a firearm as a felon and domestic abuse. "I think I said that Shug would be in jail or dead by the time you finished your book," O'Malley said. I'm sad to say I was right. After my phone went quiet for 5 months, I received a call from a Florida number. "Yo, it's Sugar," came that husky and resilient voice. "I beat the case. Nothing like a little incarceration to focus your mind." Postscript. In the summer of 2017, shortly after I completed this book, Pipe was arrested at his home on a charge filed by his wife, with whom he had been having marital issues over a potential divorce and custody of their child. Pipe is being held in jail, but how these charges will play out is anybody's guess. Shug was arrested in Brooklyn after he was caught fleeing from police and charged with possession of a gun. Detectives were unable to prove that his DNA was on the loaded weapon they recovered, and he was released from custody in December 2017. Pete Forselli won a battle with the lung cancer he contracted as a result of his role as a first responder at 9/11, and he is now a special agent in charge of the Miami Field Division of the ATF. He was a whistleblower in the Fast and Furious case and testified before Congress about lazy police work and the U.S. Attorney's Office's reluctance to prosecute straw purchasers buying guns for Mexican drug cartels. Both Pete Forselli and John O'Malley have gone on to provide crucial evidence and testimony in freeing the wrongfully convicted, including 5 people from Soundview who were sentenced to 25 years to life for the murder of a cab driver in September 1997. One of them, Eric Glisson, wrote to the Southern District asking for help. His letter was passed on to O'Malley in June 2012. O'Malley and Forselli knew it was Sex Money Murder who had carried out the killing. 2 members had admitted shooting a cab driver in Soundview, although at the time no victim had been recorded at the 43rd. O'Malley and Forselli got the Bronx DA to reopen the case, and 18 years after they first went to prison, Eric Glisson and the 4 others were released. O'Malley and Forselli continue to work on other innocence cases. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Keith Sellenwright, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2018 by Jonathan Green. Published by arrangement with W.W. Norton & Company, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.